KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native communities across the country continue to raise concerns about potential impacts from President Trump's executive orders and other administration actions. As the Mountain West News Bureau's Murphy Woodhouse reports, Native organizations from across the country are responding.
Of particular concern was a late January Office of Management and Budget memo that temporarily froze federal payments and sowed ongoing uncertainty across the country.
To see the federal funding freeze was very alarming and concerning for many folks within Indian country.
That's Matthew Campbell, Deputy Director of the Native American Rights Fund, speaking from Boulder, Colorado. His group was one of a number of Native organizations that recently sent a letter demanding the Trump administration make sure the U.S. government abides by its treaty obligations to tribal nations. The OMB memo was ultimately rescinded, but Campbell says concern remains. He noted that federal funding helps support law enforcement, education, and health care in Native communities. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski herself sent a letter to OMB demanding it direct federal agencies to ensure federal funding to tribes is not affected by Trump's executive orders. I'm Murphy Woodhouse.
Native youth are urging tribal leaders to invest in young people. Youth leaders at the National Congress of American Indians winter legislative session say young people are addressing many of the challenges facing their communities today, including climate change, education, and language revitalization. NCAI Youth Commission co-presidents Madison Brown and Angelina Cerna delivered remarks to tribal leaders gathered in Washington, D.C. this week. Cerna says indigenous knowledge, which includes young people, is a valuable tool for healing, governance, and a thriving future.
We must ensure that our leaders, our elders, our youth, and our spiritual guides are present in every room where decisions are being made about our future. It is about ensuring that our voices shape the conversation. It is about understanding that the solutions to many of the crises we face lie in the deep lived experiences of our peoples.
Brown asked tribal leaders to advance youth leadership programs to help them better understand policies and legislative processes at the tribal, state, and federal level.
The current state of Native youth is filled with hope and determination. We are not asking for permission to exist or simply to continue tribal youth programs. We are asserting our place in the world. Yes, we are youth, and there is responsibility in advancing our priorities, but we are youth with lived experiences and deeply rooted in the teachings of our elders.
A youth leadership summit is being held during the NCAI conference. Both wrap up on Thursday. Chronic wasting disease was detected for the first time on Northwest Montana's Flathead Reservation. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports tribal officials are now sampling deer herds to see how widespread the fatal disease is.
CWD is a fast-spreading disease that's 100% fatal to deer, elk, and moose. It's been detected throughout Montana, but until now hasn't been seen on Confederated Salish and Kootenai lands. The tribes say a mule deer taken by a tribal hunter tested positive. The deer was killed in the northeastern corner of the reservation. Rich Jansen is the head of the tribe's Natural Resources Department.
And our people don't want it on the reservation. That is a big thing for us because it's a culturally sensitive food source, frankly, that we utilize.
There hasn't been a documented case of humans becoming infected, but federal health officials advise against eating animals that test positive. Jensen says his staff will sample at least 150 animals to get a better understanding of how widespread the disease is. I'm Aaron Bolton.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND. Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
Reducing the number of open criminal cases and the time it takes to get them done is our number one priority.
Alaska's Chief Justice lays out her vision for the judiciary branch in a speech to lawmakers. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 12th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Trans-Alaskans and their families respond to executive orders that threaten their access to health care.
Now, there is just a general anxiety of existing in the world.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Rural Alaska residents interested in preserving subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing for future generations may consider applying to serve on the Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, which provides an open forum for public opinions and concerns regarding subsistence. Apply by Sunday, February 16th. More information at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@ios.doi.gov. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
Senator Lisa Murkowski voted today to confirm Tulsi Gabbard as President Trump's Director of National Intelligence. She also announced that she intends to vote to confirm Robert Kennedy Jr. as Secretary of Health and Human Services. Murkowski explained her decisions in social media posts. She said she's still concerned about Kennedy's stance against vaccines and what she called his selective interpretation of scientific studies. But she said Kennedy pledged to base vaccine recommendations on medically sound research. A lot of eyes are on Murkowski. She's one of the few Senate Republicans who criticizes Trump, and she has voted against one of his nominees. Pete Hegseth was confirmed as defense secretary anyway. Murkowski also said she continues to have concerns about Gabbard, who faced criticism for her friendliness toward dictators. Senator Mitch McConnell was the only Republican to vote against Gabbard's confirmation. He cited a, quote, history of alarming lapses in judgment. Murkowski, though, said she appreciates Gabbard's commitment to rein in the scope of her office and to protect the civil liberties of American citizens. Senator Dan Sullivan, like most Republicans, has voted for all of Trump's nominees. A final vote on Kennedy could come Thursday morning. Alaska Supreme Court Chief Justice Susan Carney defended the court system's work and laid out plans for the future in a speech to state lawmakers today. Carney spent a significant part of her first State of the Judiciary address responding to concerns raised in recent news stories from the Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica, highlighting years-long delays in court proceedings. In one case, it took 7 years for a sexual assault witnessed by a police officer to go to trial. Another sexual assault case had gone more than a decade without a trial. The reports highlighted the growing time it takes to resolve the most serious crimes like rape and murder. Carney says the court system is working to be more efficient. She says courts are now closing more cases than they open every year, and the number of open cases is down by a third over the past year.
But we know that we have more work to do. Reducing the number of open criminal cases and the time it takes to get them done is our number one priority.
Carney says the delays are, quote, not typical. She says the average misdemeanor is resolved in 6 months or less, and felonies, short of the most serious charges, typically are closed in roughly a year. Unclassified felonies, including rape and murder, take an average of 3 years, triple what they took a decade ago. Carney highlighted a few efforts aimed at making courts more efficient, things like rules limiting delays, calling retired judges in to hear cases, and training aimed at speeding the process. But Carney told lawmakers that there's only so much the court system can do.
3 years is a long time for victims and for other people involved in those cases. But those are the most serious cases. The facts tend to be more complicated. The number of people tend to be larger. The evidence issues that can arise can be very complex, and there's always constitutional concerns. It's very hard to shorten the time that those cases get.
Carney also asked lawmakers to support the court system's budget requests, including the next phase of a project that would add new courtrooms in Palmer to support the fastest-growing area of the state. Carney presides over the state's first majority female Supreme Court and delivered the speech to a legislature that also includes the state's first majority female House of Representatives. Well, in his first few weeks in office, President Donald Trump has issued a barrage of executive orders aimed at transgender or trans Alaskans. Some impact access to health care or could in the future. That's leaving many trans Alaskans scared for their health and their mental health. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra spoke with trans Alaskans and their families and has this story.
So this is my kid's stuff.
That's a mom who doesn't want to give her name because she's worried for her family. We'll identify her by her first initial, L.
They had a serious needle phobia.
L lives in Alaska with her 16-year-old non-binary transmasculine kid, who uses both he and they pronouns. She pulls out a plastic bag full of about 15 small white boxes with prescription labels.
And this we got right, like, the day after the election. That's not as much as it probably looks like, but it should last close to a year.
Inside the boxes are glass bottles of testosterone. That's part of her kid's gender-affirming health care. She said she was worried about whether they would be able to fill his prescriptions once Trump took office.
We were in a panic.
It's taken her and her family years to navigate her kid's gender journey and land on care that works for them. When he hit puberty, she says her kid became a shell of a person. They were anxious, depressed, and self-harming.
We spent a lot of time at night trying to problem solve, like, what can we do? Where can we go? And honestly, worrying that we were going to find them dead in the morning. And it wasn't until we accessed gender-affirming care, which can mean a host of things, but until we accessed hormones, that it was almost like a magic bullet for them.
Trump has issued at least 5 executive orders during his first few weeks in office aimed at trans people. And one is already making it difficult for some trans and non-binary people to access care. Medicaid and TRICARE no longer cover gender-affirming care for people 19 and under. And more executive orders are likely to impact trans and queer rights and care moving forward. One allows the right to deny coverage for religious reasons, and others order federal organizations to enforce a strict sex binary. There are already lawsuits challenging some of those orders. The tone of Trump's executive orders isn't a surprise to Elle. Everyone in her tight-knit queer and trans community has been preparing for a Trump presidency.
I know where we were, and we can't go back there. I can't do that to my kids, so we will do whatever we have to do. We'll go into debt. We will go to other countries.
This stress, fear, and confusion is something that Identity Health Clinic in Anchorage sees a lot of lately in their patients. The clinic is the largest provider of gender-affirming care in the state, and many patients rely on Medicaid. Tom Pittman is Identity's executive director, and he says they've seen Medicaid denials of coverage for minors already. But despite changes in coverage, he says it's legal to seek health care.
It is a right. It is a right, and we get to have the respect of the society that we live in to do that. It's under attack, but we still get to right now.
Identity has a legal and insurance team to help patients understand their rights and navigate insurance claims. And he says they're planning to launch a fund to financially support patients whose care isn't covered. But he says even if patients can still access health care, the executive orders ostracize trans people.
Then when you take someone that has already interacted with society, knowing that there are people out there that disrespect them, that want to push them down, and then you do this to them, it becomes something that's an official act of their government. That's even worse. That's even more destabilizing.
That destabilization is something H, a trans woman in Alaska, has been wrestling with. We're also identifying her by her first initial.
I haven't, like, questioned my safety this much, even when I was working in, like, the fishing industry, you know. Even in places that I've been, like, assaulted for being trans. Now there is just a general anxiety of existing in the world.
H is also seeing the impacts of executive orders ripple through her community. Some trans women she knows are leaving the country because they're scared for their health and safety. Several of the executive orders specifically target trans women.
I'm so afraid of losing people. Ugh. I've had friends that have submitted themselves to residential treatments already. Like this is f***ing real. I was like thinking to myself, riding these ups and downs. I was like, man, if I don't take care of myself, like I'm afraid for myself. Like I don't want to have a mental breakdown.
H is an artist, and she says through all of this stress and sorrow, her art has been a lifeline. Making art about all of this is what she now sees as a purpose in this world.
As much as they try and separate us, we have the tools to build those connections and to create strong community. And that is, like, honestly the greatest form of resistance that you can have.
She says throughout history, trans women have always found each other and supported each other. And she says she and her trans sisters in Alaska are doing that now. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a report aims to show Haines residents where future landslides may occur.
There's probably been a history of different slides reshaping what that whole face even looks like. All this is slide, slide, slide.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Ensure the vitality of public radio by including it in your estate planning. Together, we build a sustainable future for quality media. Thank you.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. From local businesses to fiscal policy to big industries like fishing, tourism, and oil and gas, I'll cover the high-stakes economic issues that matter to Alaskans all over the state. That's the Alaska Economic Report with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
A judge ruled Tuesday that the municipality of Anchorage has the authority to clear out a homeless encampment. The ruling comes after the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska sued the city on Thursday, asking for a temporary restraining order against the city's plans to abate an encampment near North Star Elementary School. The ACLU argued that removing people from the camp while city shelters are at full capacity constituted cruel and unusual punishment, and the city had not given proper notice to campers. However, Superior Court Judge Adolf Zeman ruled in favor of the city, which argued the camp is a public safety risk, citing thousands of pounds of trash and a high volume of police calls in the area, as well as its proximity to a school. In a statement, Mayor Suzanne LaFrance said, quote, "We will continue to use abatement as a public safety tool when necessary, just as we will continue to connect people to housing and shelter," end quote. ACLU spokeswoman Megan Barker said the organization was disappointed with the ruling, writing, quote, "This abatement will just push people to another outdoor space somewhere else in the city and will not help address the housing crisis we face," end quote. The city began clearing out the camp on Monday. Municipal officials say the city has cleared 17 camps since July 1st. A new report in Haines chronicles which parts of the mountainous borough may be prone to future landslides. It comes as communities across Alaska and beyond scramble to prepare for natural disasters that are growing more destructive with climate change. The first step is often working to better understand the risk and map where it lies. But as Avery Elfelt reports for the Alaska Desk, it's rarely that simple.
If you drive north on Lutak Road in Haines, you'll see snow-covered peaks towering above the ocean below. But if you look even closer, you might notice something else: vertical gashes running down the mountain face. The incisions mark where landslides, or maybe avalanches, have struck before, taking trees, soil, and rocks down with them. Patty Brown chairs the Haines Planning Commission. She points to a slide path while out for a drive on a cold, clear day back in January.
There's probably been a history of different slides reshaping what that whole face even looks like. All this is slide, slide, slide.
A new report aims to address that reality by mapping the local landscape and pinpointing areas that might be more prone to slides down the line. Brown says the multi-year effort, which was paid for with federal funding, began after an atmospheric river dumped record levels of rain on Haines in 2020. The storm washed out roads and triggered landslides, including one that killed two beloved community members.
It was associated with such a radical weather event
those are going to keep getting more dramatic and be beyond what we predicted. So we better have some kind of an inventory of what to expect.
The 2020 event and resulting maps are part of a bigger story about intensifying natural disasters and how communities across Alaska and the U.S. are responding. As climate change and development feel more destructive disasters, including floods, slides, and wildfires, local governments are trying to get ahead of the problem without also threatening homes and livelihoods. The Haines Report is composed of three different maps. Jillian Nicolazzo, a landslide-focused geologist with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, co-authored the report. She says the maps are made using light detection and ranging technology, which sends down light pulses from planes and helicopters that bounce off trees, buildings, and slopes.
So you can think of it kind of like a flashlight that's shining down. Where does that light hit? Where does it pass through?
Nicolazzo says the data that results is used to create maps that depict the landscape and what's on it. Local governments, communities, and homeowners can then reference the information when making crucial decisions about where to build housing, roads, schools, and more. Haines is not the only community interested in mapping the risk. Similar projects have been completed or are underway in more than half a dozen other communities in Southeast, in part due to four fatal landslides in the last decade. But the efforts aren't without controversy. Ron Heinz is a senior researcher at the Sitka Sound Science Center, a nonprofit that's played a key role in confronting landslide risk in Southeast.
Everybody wants to see a hazard map, and they want to see if they're exposed to any sort of hazard, but they don't want any sort of official acceptance or understanding of these hazard maps.
Take Juneau. In 2020, the local assembly unanimously voted against adopting newly commissioned hazard maps, which place some neighborhoods in landslide zones for the first time. They did so over concerns that the maps would drive down property values or impact insurance. Todd Winkle is a Haines resident who owns property right next to the fatal 2020 slide. He says that people in Sitka warned Haines residents to push back against potential risk mapping after the disaster. That was partially due to worries over real estate, but it was also because people felt the mapping would only be beneficial if the local government focused on helping landowners actively mitigate the risk. Winkle agrees. He says Haines should focus instead on reducing the threat in areas that are clearly landslide prone.
If you're not going to do anything, don't risk assess it.
The Haines Planning Commission, for its part, hopes the map will help the community gauge and respond to the risk. That could include by encouraging consultation with an engineer before developing somewhere that's landslide prone. The commission does not plan to use the map for regulatory purposes. Back in the car, Brown, with the Planning Commission, says there is a long history of landslides in Haines, and that the community is highly attuned to that reality. Still, she says, the deadly landslide in 2020 made at least one thing clear. The risk can hide in plain sight.
It was a forested slope, and we like to be confident. Oh, it's got plenty of vegetation holding the soil, but it's steep. Once something's really forested, I think you lose track of how steep it actually is under there.
The threat is only growing as weather grows more extreme and temperatures rise with climate change. In Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
The Ketchikan School Board is considering closing a school, a decision several districts in the state have made recently to address budget shortfalls. During their meeting tonight, the board is discussing closing Point Higgins, one of the island's three elementary schools. They're also scheduled to, once again, consider restructuring elementary schools by grade level. But Board President Michelle O'Brien doesn't anticipate a vote on either plan this week.
I anticipate no action unless there's some surprise to me. And the reason that I say that is we're launching into a series of community listening sessions.
O'Brien says they need more time to hear public feedback about these newly presented budget options. The plan to close Point Higgins Elementary comes from the assumption that the district would receive no additional state funding for next year. Up until now, the district has been working with a budget that assumes a one-time state funding increase matching the amount passed last year. In that scenario, the administration projects about a $1.7 million budget deficit. But if the state approves no new funding, as Governor Mike Dunleavy's budget proposal recommends, that deficit balloons to nearly $6 million. Point Higgins Elementary is located about a half-hour drive north of downtown Ketchikan and serves many families who live at that end of the island. Closing the school would cover less than half of the $6 million deficit and would still require cutting 16 teachers plus librarians and athletic staff at the remaining buildings. O'Brien says they're presenting a budget based on what they know, but that could always change if the state approves more funding.
Who knows what the state will do? They haven't had the respect to give the communities any sort of notice in a timely fashion.
The budget presentation also includes a list of what could be added back to the budget based on increases in state funding. O'Brien is urging residents to reach out to legislators across the state to advocate for school funding. She's scheduled to testify before the House Finance Committee tonight to discuss the importance of schools for economic development. O'Brien says the local decisions still need to happen soon, and the board will likely vote on the budget during their first meeting in March.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, providing telecommunication services to tribal health organizations and nonprofit rural health providers, enabling telehealth services for Alaskans. More at gci.com/healthcare. How does Alaska's land fund community services for Alaskans with behavioral health conditions and developmental disabilities? Through the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The Trust Land Office manages 1 million acres of lands to maximize revenue generation, with earnings supporting millions of dollars in trust grant making each year to help improve mental health outcomes for beneficiaries statewide. More at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
A Fairbanks legislator wants the state to have an official dinosaur, and he's suggesting that it be a type of tyrannosaur whose remains were found on Alaska's North Slope. Republican Representative Will Stapp introduced a bill Tuesday asking the legislature to designate the Nanuksaurus as Alaska's state dinosaur. Its bones and teeth were discovered more than 30 years ago, and it's thought to be a cousin of the T-Rex, an apex predator of its time. Stapp says an artist's rendition of the Nanuksaurus caught his eye, but he admitted he chose it because of its namesake, the University of Alaska Fairbanks Nanuk mascot.
I would be lying if I didn't see the name Nanuksaurus as a Fairbanks person and say, well, that probably should be the dinosaur. Conceptually, to me, it's like, okay, well, this is a really cool area of research at UAF that I didn't really know about.
UAF's Pat Druckenmiller, a paleontologist and director of the UA Museum of the North, says he likes the proposal to name a state dinosaur and appreciates staff's support for the university's dinosaur research. But for now, Druckenmiller isn't so sure that Nanuksaurus is the best choice.
When that Nanuksaurus was first named, it was really just based on a handful of bones, and I mean literally a handful of bones. And that's not typically considered adequate information to properly diagnose a new species.
Since then, Druckenmiller says researchers have collected more of Nanuksaurus's fossils, done more analysis, and that new research is currently under review.
We believe Nanuksaurus is a valid species. However, the features that were originally used to recognize it as distinct from other tyrannosaurs, we do not think is valid.
And so Druckenmiller says it's complicated. Until the research makes it through the review process, Nanuksaurus's status remains in limbo. Representative Stapp says he's heard about the issue with Nanuksaurus's species classification, but he expects that will be resolved in committees as his bill moves forward. And Stapp says he's been getting a lot of emails with other suggestions.
I heard a seawolfosaurus, but I don't know if that's a real dinosaur. Let's put it that way.
At least 16 United States have an official state dinosaur, as does Washington, D.C., with its aptly named Capitalsaurus. Kwithluk dog musher Raymond Alexi took first place in the 2025 Akiak Dash on Saturday. KYUK's Samantha Watson was at the finish line.
First place in the 2025 Akiak Dash. Here he comes.
As golden hour Alaska sunlight cast over the frozen Kuskokwim River, Kwithluk musher Raymond Alexi pulled through the finish line of the 2025 Akiak Dash. It was a first place victory, with 15 minutes behind him and the closest competitor. Tongue out and bootied, his dogs looked like happy champions too.
They're really good together, most of them.
Alexi finished the 65-mile race to above the village of Akiak and back at 4:49 p.m. on Saturday, February 8th. The 21-year-old finished with all eight of his starting dogs on the line and was awarded $7,000 out of the race's $50,000 total purse.
It's Alexei's second career win in the Akiak Dash after his 2023 win during an undefeated season. Last year, Alexei didn't run the Akiak Dash because he was running his rookie Kuskokwim 300, but he withdrew just over 24 hours into that race. This year, Alexei was slated to race the K300 again, but dropped out in the week leading up to the race. This allowed him to compete in this year's Dash. He says to win felt good, but also...
just the same old, same old.
Alexei said his decision not to run the K300 was based on the warm conditions of this winter season.
Lack of training from the warm weather. Middle of December, I went out to Denali Highway to train, and I think it helped that for the dogs.
He says he next plans to compete in the Bogus Creek 150 later this winter, which has been his main focus race for the past 3 years. Coming in 15 minutes behind Alexei, Michael Larson of Queethluk took second place and a prize of $5,500. Larson competed with Raymond Alexei's B team from Alexei Kennels and crossed the finish line with a team of 8 dogs. 2024 Akiak Dash champ Chauvelier Wassily Jr. of Akiachuk claimed third place with 8 dogs on the line. The teenager turned heads at last year's Dash, walking away with the Rookie of the Year award as well as first place. This year, he says, he had another good race.
Tell me about the conditions out there. How did he find the trail?
It was pretty good, smooth.
At this point in the Dash's 33-year history, there's a generational yet competitive gap between seasoned mushers and younger rookies. Last year, then 16-year-old Chauvelier Wassily Jr. won his rookie year, and Raymond Alexei took first place in 2023. At 19, it was his third year racing in the Dash. Top finishers Charlie Chingliak, Spiridon Cheney, and Eamon Frederick are also teenagers. Musher John George of Akiachuk is the 2014 Akiak Dash champion. This year, he came in 10th place.
I've seen very whole bunch of young boys, you know. I can't catch up with them.
The Akiak Dash has also long been dominated by a roster of local racers, particularly from the villages of Queethluk and Akiachuk. This year, 11 of the 16 Dash competitors were from Akiachuk. Musher Spiridon Cheney was the only of the bunch from another community, downriver Nebuskiak. During the Akiak Dash, temperatures wavered in the high 20s with some sun. With no drop dogs allowed in the race, several mushers carried a lagging dog across the finish line in their sled. Musher Darren George said it was too hot. The heat posed challenges for the dogs, including the one half peeking out of his sled bag at the finish. Some Dash mushers, John George and Raymond Alexei among them, said that they plan to race the Bogus Creek 150, which is slated to start on February 22nd. For several of them, whether or not they make it to the start comes down to favorable training conditions between now and the race day. In Bethel, I'm Samantha Watson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Eric Stone in Juneau, Rachel Cassandra and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Avery Elfelt in Haines, Michael Finelli in Ketchikan, and Samantha Watson in Bethel. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky's our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support. If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.
Whether I'm right or wrong, there's no phrase that hits. like an ocean needs the sand, or a dirty old shoe that fits. And if all the world was perfect, I would only ever want to see your scars. You know they can have their universe, but we'll be in the dirt designing stars. And darling, you know when you made me feel so beautiful. Nowhere else in the world I wanna be. You made me feel so beautiful. Oh, oh, oh. Whether I'm up or down, there's no crowd to please. I'm like a faith without a clause to believe. Smiling, I would only ever want to see your frown. You know they can sail away in sunsets. We'll be right here stranded on the ground. Just happy to be found. You made me feel so beautiful. In the world I wanna be. You make me feel so beautiful. Oh, oh, oh. I have lost my illusions. I have drowned in your words. I have left my confusion to a cynical world. I am throwing myself at things I don't understand.
hand has scaled the grand old face of the plateau. Some belong to strangers and some to folks you know. Holy ghosts and talk show hosts are planted in the sand to beautify the foothills, shake the many hands. There's nothing on the top but a bucket and a mop and an illustrated book about birds. You see a lot up there, but don't be scared. Who needs Jackson when you got words? Fish with a mop, then you can't stop and look at what you've done. Plateau's clean, no dirt to be seen in the work. It was fun. Nothing on the top but a bucket and a mop and an illustrated book about birds. See a lot up there, but don't be scared. Who needs action when you got words? Many hands began to scan around for the next plateau. Some say it was Greenland, some say Mexico. Others decided it was nowhere except for where they stood. Those were all just guesses, wouldn't help you if they could.
That's thing two. Cover your hair and your eyes then. Okay, this is called Oh Me.
Breaking my bet you the diamonds are real. And I bet you his house is a big one up on the hill.